we are really a low tax country, but we're trying to run a set of government services, welfare and health, education and so on the same par as people like Canada and New Zealand, but without paying as much.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast. Economic debates are always centre stage in our politics. And as we approach the next election, questions around inequality, fairness, taxation and economic management are being hotly contested. A new book called Fair Share, Competing Claims and Australia's Economic Future explores these and other issues, putting them in their international and historical contexts. It's been written by Stephen Bell, Professor of Political Economy at the University of Queensland, and Michael Keating. In his long career in the senior ranks of the Commonwealth Public Service, Dr. Keating headed the Federal Departments of Employment and Industrial Relations, Finance and Prime Minister in Cabinet, and he was a bureaucratic participant in the economic reforms of the Hawke-Keating period. He joins us today to talk about the book and the issues. Michael Keating, in Fair Share, you point out that Australia has done well economically when compared to other developed countries. Why was this so?
I think there are two reasons. The first is the neoliberal reforms in favour of increased competitiveness and flexibility for the Australian economy, which were introduced in the 1980s and 1990s. One result of that is that our book argues that the Australian labour market is now more flexible than the US labour market. And that's quite important in adjusting to structural adjustment. And the second reason is that Australia's done quite a good job, better job than most countries, in looking after the people who are disadvantaged by change, whether it be policy change or structural change and so on. One example of that is that the social wage was increased as part of the accord in the 1980s and into the 1990s. But then the Howard government, for example, when it introduced the GST, low-income groups actually, who the GST might otherwise have damaged, they got compensation, which actually added up to more than they paid in the GST.
So, in a sense, we had reform on the supply side, but we also had protection on the demand side of the economy.
Yes.
But the picture you paint about the future, I must say, is bleaker. You say that the Australian economy is likely to see slower growth, rising inequality and unhappy losers, and that this will require more attention to the issues of distribution. Now, what's driving this more gloomy outlook?
Well, I think it's worth stepping back and looking at what's been happening in the rest of the world and then ask yourself, how far are we different? How far will we stay different? If you look at the rest of the world, since 2000, that is the beginning of this century, the OECD growth has averaged less than 2% annually and only 1.3% annually since the GFC, whereas in the previous 30 years, from the 1970s up to the 2000s, OECD growth was averaging about 3% annually. So that's a very big change in economic growth and prospects that we've been experiencing in the developed world as a whole. The big problem, and what's underpinned that, we argue, is rising inequality. And that's led to a shortage of demand, if only because the rich have a higher savings rate. And so if the poor are going backwards, they're the ones who consume, the rich save, we've had a shortage of demand. Also, in most countries, but not Australia at least until very recently, wages have lagged productivity growth and the profit share has increased over the last 30 or more years in most countries. Just to give you an example from the US, which is an extreme case, but in the US, the typical male worker has a lower wage today than he had 45 years ago, or if you like, than his grandfather had. Now, the American dream was quite opposite of that. The American dream was that if you worked hard and were a good citizen, you'd get ahead, not go backwards. Now, until the GFC, the problem of inadequate demand was postponed, in a sense, by rising debt. We had a big increase in household debt, but that was what led to the GFC. And since the GFC, that escape valve has been closed. And that's why, since the GFC, you know, growth has been really pathetic. It's because the escape valve of debt has been closed. And finally, that very slow continuing growth in demand is now resulting in lower growth of supply. So, you know, full employment has returned in the US, but why has it returned? It's returned because employment participation, that is the proportion of people in jobs, has actually fallen. And the workforce has contracted as the people who originally became unemployed have actually quit the workforce. In addition, productivity growth is also down, and that is probably because there's been less investment because of the low consumer demand. And that's reduced innovation. Innovation is actually realised through investment. We've had less investment, less innovation, and then again productivity has been affected by the loss of skills caused by this long period of economic secular stagnation.
Can we just unpack in the Australian context this question of inequality? Because at least in political terms at the moment, this is very much a sharp-edged debate. But it's always confusing to really know the facts. Statistics fly all over the place by the various people arguing their cases, whether inequality has got significantly worse, how serious it is, and so on. How do you read the evidence about the present situation and about future directions?
Well, I've relied very heavily on the OECD data on inequality, which I think is comprehensive. It's signed off by all the countries. Certainly the Australian data comes from the ABS, and that's true of the other countries, I believe. If you look at the OECD data, income inequality has risen in 17 out of 22 advanced countries, 17 out of 22 since the mid-1980s. I think that is pretty authoritative. Interestingly, the biggest increases were in Sweden, New Zealand and the US in that order. Other large increases in inequality were recorded in Finland, Germany, Israel and Luxembourg. Now, a lot of people blame neoliberalism for their inequality. I never see them cite any evidence which would suggest cause and effect or even what they mean by neoliberalism. But it's very hard to imagine that neoliberalism was a cause of increased inequality in Sweden, Germany or Finland.
And where are we in all that?
Coming to us, inequality rose less in Australia than almost all other advanced countries. Our starting point was we're about the average in terms of, or a bit more unequal than the average. So I'm not saying inequality is not a problem in Australia. All I'm saying is that in the last 30 years, inequality has not risen by a great deal in Australia. The rise in inequality in Australia was very much concentrated in the early 2000s. And one interesting factor in all this was that if you take the 30 years from the mid-1980s to 2015, Australian wage growth broadly matched productivity growth, whereas in most OECD countries it didn't. Wage growth didn't match productivity growth. But there are signs that wages are now starting to rise by less than productivity, and that's one of the reasons for being concerned about Australia going forward from here. I think the thing I want to focus on then is why has inequality risen? And it's not neoliberalism, I don't believe, which, if you like, would be something policy could affect. We looked at the various drivers, and we relied quite heavily on the OECD for this, but not only on the OECD. The IMF has similar conclusions, and the literature, more general academic literature. And so we looked at technological change, we looked at globalisation, we looked at government regulation, and we looked at what they call financialisation, which is the huge growth in the finance sector. And the I think the evidence is pretty compelling that the principal driver of the increase in inequality has been technological change. Essentially, technological change in the last three decades has impacted most heavily on routine jobs, and they tend to be in the middle of the job spectrum. So you're hollowing out these middle-level jobs, and growth in jobs is at the top and the bottom. And as a matter of arithmetic, that will show up as an increase in inequality, even if you had no changes in relative wages. Some countries also had a change in relative wages. The other point I think that's important is that the top 1% have had a huge increase in income. And while that is not the most important reason for the rise in inequality, it's certainly an important reason. Not the most important, but it's a significant factor. And the increase in the top 1% can't really be explained by technology, because it varies so much from country to country, but the technology doesn't change that much from country to country. There's literature in Australia which suggests that increase in incomes of the top 1% have been very much driven by rent seeking. By that I mean the people who are getting paid the most are very often in industries where there's a lot of government regulation, like developers, for example, or miners, permission to mine and so on. So you've got rent seeking there. Financialisation, again, the finance sector has driven pay up for the very rich. And that's possibly been associated with a change in culture too. Yeah, I saw an article, I think it was today's paper or yesterday's paper, along the lines that top public servants are now getting a lot more relative to the average wage in the public service than they did when I was a top public servant, a lot more. That I think reflects a change in culture.
Now,
so just to finish that point, I think if we want to think about the policies then to slow rising inequality or halt it, then you've got to focus on the causes.
You advocate an agenda for the future to sustain what you call inclusive economic growth. Now, it's an extensive agenda. We can't go through it all. But can you explain the challenges of distribution that you see and give us a taste of what you think are the main things that need to be done?
Well, I'm going to focus on the two biggest things, and that really derives from what I've just described as the cause of inequality. If technological change is the main driver of increasing inequality, then I think it follows that the most important policy relates to education and training, because that will help people adjust to technological change. It'll help them adopt technological change, not resist it, and it'll help them adapt to if they're better skilled. And just to give you an example of how important that can be, if we compare the US and Australia over the last 30 years or so, you'll find that the premium for being a graduate in the US has doubled over the last 30 years or so. But the number of graduates has hardly changed, partly because it's so damned expensive to go and get a degree. Whereas in Australia, the premium for being a graduate hasn't changed very much at all in the last 30 years or so, but the number of graduates has more than doubled. And so that gives you an indication of how you can affect wage relativities by operating on the supply side. But in terms of priorities, I think the biggest priority would be to shift resources to disadvantaged schools, and that really goes to implementing the Gonski agenda without side deals in favour of various disaffected groups.
We're now seeing more, at least to a fair degree.
Yeah, they're making progress, but I'm leery about the implementation, to be honest. I think we need to increase funding for vocational education and training, which has been heavily cut. That was quite the wrong thing to do. And I think we need to change the courses to make students more adaptable to change. The way VET educational training, the assessment is very much focused on very specific competencies relating to today's jobs and doesn't really prepare them as well as they might for tomorrow's jobs. The other policy area that I want to mention is that we need to address the inequality of wealth. We risk becoming an increasingly patrimonial society. I mean, this is more true of other countries, but it's true of Australia also. And that would mean a lack of opportunity, and particularly in Australia, there's a huge spatial inequality which has developed.
Spatial in the sense of...
Locational. Where you live affects your opportunities. If I go back to the mid-1970s, it didn't matter where you lived in Australia, your chances of getting a job were exactly the same. The employment participation rate was the same wherever you lived. It might have been the same job. You at least had the same chances of being employed. Today, for a male, the participation rate, that is the chance of being employed, is about 10% lower in the lower socioeconomic areas on the fringe of our big cities. That really leads me to say that, you know, they're not getting the access to quality schools and so on, not getting the access to jobs when they live on the city, the, you know, 60k from the edge, from the centre of Sydney. And really, we need to change the zoning system. I mean, we badly need much more infill in our middle inner suburbs, which are repelling all borders, if I could put it that way. And recent research by the RBA, which has been published since we wrote our book, finds that zoning is adding almost $500,000 to the average price of a home in Sydney. Now, another way of expressing that is it's almost doubling the cost of the average home in Sydney. And that really means we risk becoming two very different societies based on where you live, and that will affect your future opportunities.
Now, you also advocate in your book that we need to actually increase the tax take. This, I have to say, is a pretty unpopular notion politically, and I wonder, first, how you think politicians can sell that, but secondly, how you think we should go about it. Is this is the best way, an increase, for example, in the GST? You do float the possibility of the reintroduction of death duties and increasing the top rate. Courageous, I would have thought, if you were a politician going down those routes. But how do we actually achieve this?
Okay, well, look, let me say up front, yes, I agree it would be hard, but I don't accept that it's impossible. And indeed, you must have seen the sort of social surveys that are done, which strongly suggest the majority of people would prefer to maintain expenditures and pay more tax if they had to, rather than have the
expenses. They say that.
Yeah, they say that.
But would they vote for that rather than if they're asked to increase tax?
I think I take it at face value that if they were faced with that, if they really thought they were faced with that choice, they'd say, yes, we'd pay the taxes. I don't find it an accident that no one's actually proposed major cuts in expenditure of any significance. Even the first Abbott budget, which was rejected by the nation pretty strongly, I don't think got anywhere near the cuts in taxation that we're going to need, and I'll get onto that in a minute. If you look at the government's own intergenerational report, which, you know, projects future expenditure, and that's on their policies and their work, their own projections, they show that they reckon they'll get back into surplus in a couple of years. Well, you can take that promise for as you wish. I just note that it's been broken regularly every time it's been made. But even on if you accept that promise that they're going to get back in 2021 or whatever it is, in less than 10 years from now, they'll be back in deficit on their own numbers. And by 2050, the deficit will be as 6% of GDP. 6% of GDP, not 1% or 2%. Now, no one's ever suggested a package of expenditure savings that would come anywhere near 6% of GDP. You know, a big package of expenditure savings is one a bit percent of GDP. So I think we've got to face up the fact We actually raise taxation for a purpose. It's not just sort of put in some politician's back pocket or something. And I just want to quote the great American jurist, Oliver Wendell Holmes, who said, "I like to pay taxes, and this way I buy civilization." And that's what taxation is about. It's about buying civilization. Now, in our book, we project that over the next 30 or more years, the taxation revenue will need to rise by another 3 percentage points of GDP. That would still leave Australia as a low-tax country, with a level of taxation no higher than countries like New Zealand or Canada today. Now, they're countries that are comparable to us, but we're currently 3 percentage points of GDP below them in terms of our revenue. Now, we are really a low-tax country, but we're trying to run a set of government services, welfare and health, education and so on the same par as people like Canada and New Zealand, but without paying as much.
So would you rely in part on fiscal drag? Would you deal with the GST, put the rate up? Where would you go?
I'll come to sort of how to do it in a minute, but you know, I accept the political difficulties, and to me that means we need to change the debate. Governments have got to be prepared to run a debate, sponsor a debate, about what we as a nation expect of government in the future, and then how we're going to pay for it. Now, let's go to how we're going to pay for it here, but I think it will need a widespread debate. Our book's a contribution to starting that debate. You know, what is the best way to increase your taxation? And I do emphasise, the main issue to me is that we need to increase it. I'm less concerned with which way we do it, but I think there are some observations I can make about what's the best way. I think the best way is to start with the tax concessions that are around. Remember, those tax concessions are really the same as government expenditures, except they're done on the revenue side, and that way they escape scrutiny. In my view, they're beloved by the National Party, precisely because they escape scrutiny. Often they're not cash limited either. And that's where, if I can make a comment, the ALP's proposals have focused. They're focused on these tax concessions and how cost-effective they are, and you know, and whether some of them really are fair and whether they should be got rid of. Certainly, the GST is an obvious tax to increase, as you mentioned. The problem for the Commonwealth is that the GST revenue at the present, and by law at present, flows entirely to the states. So an increase in the GST per se does not improve the Commonwealth budget position one single cent. Now, the Commonwealth could improve its budget position if it cut other specific purpose payments to the states, because the states got more untied revenue through the GST. But if, you know, there's a question whether the Commonwealth wants to cut all the expenditure it has on schools, on roads, on hospitals and so on. Would they want to do that? And let's see, even if they did, to balance the Commonwealth budget going out, you'd have to get rid of the whole lot, and still the GST wouldn't have raised enough revenue. So I take the view that some increase in income tax seems unavoidable. I think it would be a pity if that were achieved just through fiscal drag, because I think fiscal drag affects the progressivity of the tax system, and it would be better to make a considered decision on what the rate scale should be rather than just accept it being determined by the rate of inflation.
Now, you say that the theory of trickle-down economics is, in your words, a fraud, and that cutting company tax is essentially a waste of money. So you obviously would think that the Senate should reject the legislation now before it to cut the rate for big companies. But do you argue, or can it be convincingly argued, that it won't matter if Australia is left with a higher rate compared with other countries?
Well, first of all, yeah, I agree it's a fraud, and it'd be better if the Senate rejected it. You've quoted me correctly there. Secondly, the best argument for reducing company tax is the competitiveness argument with other countries. In fact, it's really the only argument, in my view, because there is effectively no company tax on dividends paid to Australians, so you're cutting nothing. Now, against that, you need to remember a few things about company tax, even for foreigners. It's not the main driver of investment in any country. For example, Sweden and Germany have much higher company tax rates than their competitors, but they're both growing more strongly and investing more strongly than their competitors. The second thing is that the average tax rates can be much less than the apparent tax rate because of concessions. And in fact, in Australia's case, we have the fourth lowest average company tax rate in the OECD. Our company tax average company tax rate is only 17% in Australia, notwithstanding the apparent company tax rate is as much as 30%, but the actual rate they pay is 17%. And that partly reflects the fact that many foreign companies pay no or little tax. And that's a problem in itself. But going to investment and trickle down, demand for the company's products are the main driver of investment. It doesn't make sense to invest in a machine to produce more motor cars if you can't sell your existing stock of cars. And that's a very simple axiom that all companies operate on. Indeed, profits at the moment are very high around the globe, including Australia. But the US corporations are returning more profits to shareholders than they're actually spending on real investment. They're returning more profits to shareholders via dividends and share buybacks. And just to tell you the reaction to the company tax cut that Trump got through at the end of last year, in the first 6 weeks of this year following that company tax cut, US companies announced a record $171 billion of share buybacks. Now, that's more than double the $76 billion announced for the same period last year. So they were giving back all the profits and share buybacks and not investing them last year, but they jacked the rate up in response to Trump's generosity. So, you know, all the tax cuts have achieved is a huge increase in share buybacks and a huge increase in managers' remuneration, which are tied to share prices, which go up when you buy back your shares, and they haven't produced any investment at all.
From what we see now, the next election here is shaping up to be something of a generational war, with the Coalition proposing policies targeted at older voters and Labor looking to the aspirational young. Do you feel that policy in this country has been skewed too much to the generational haves, notably baby boomers and retirees, to the disadvantage of younger people?
Well, of course, I come from the retirees pre-baby boomer group, so you might say I'm biased in response.
I'm sure you'll be objective in your assessment.
No, I do actually think that this generational conflict is exaggerated, and I'd like to just spend a minute or two on why. Demographic ageing of populations is a much bigger problem anywhere else in the world than Australia. Our population is ageing much, much less than all other countries.
That's because of migration, presumably.
That's because of migration. And that's a good reason for migration, apart from several other good reasons. And secondly, if we do the projections of future expenditures, we find the increased cost of caring for the elderly, that's to say principally through pensions and healthcare actually being more important than pensions, but that increase in cost is projected to be less than the impact of technological change on public health expenditures. Technological change produces new medical services, treatments,
Which are expensive,
which people demand. I haven't seen governments resisting these expenses. It goes back to my point earlier about what people want. And so that we've accepted the cost of technological change in the past and cost the public purse, and I think we should go on accepting. And I don't see that an increase in 3% increase in revenue, which would balance the books over time, over 30 years, I don't think that's a huge price to pay. I mean, I think that should be acceptable. My biggest concern would be the huge disparities in wealth and how that's affecting equality of opportunity, not intergenerational conflict, but the prospect that we will have a two-class society in a way we've never known it because of the inequalities in wealth. I mean, already you're seeing rich parents being able to do much more for their children, both in terms of their education, but also in helping to pay for their homes now. And poorer, the children of poorer people are just missing out on both their education and on their housing. I mean, housing ownership rates are falling for the young like mad. But they're not falling for the people, young people who've got rich parents.
So this is sort of a modern class thing rather than an age thing as such.
Yeah, saying. I would react that. And it's really looking ahead. We are looking at a very unequal society in the future in terms of equality of opportunity. Now, capitalism was always recognised there'd be some inequality with capitalism, but they never tried to say there should be inequality of opportunity. They accepted that some people could command more money than others because they had more skills. But capitalism never said that their children should automatically miss out irrespective of their level of skills.
There's a lot of debate at the moment, of course, about Labor's proposed crackdown on cash rebates from franked dividends, which affects a lot of older people, retired people, many of them quite well off, but with not a big taxable income. What's your opinion of this policy? Do you think it's well-based?
Yeah, I don't think it's a big deal, to be quite honest. Just emphasise, you said they're not well off in taxable income, but in fact, I think the examples
they're
of
well
people
off
who
in
are
real income.
Yeah, they're real off in their disposable yes. income. And I just thought we got a lot of fake news. I mean, we never actually got the details of these people of why they had so little income. I think there was just fake news. And so, you know, my view, the only people, now that Labor's anyway changed the policy so that pensioners aren't going to get missed out on their cash rebate, I can only see people who are very well off paying it. And that will raise useful revenue with no damage to the economy whatsoever.
Now, just finally, we've talked about political circumstances in the 1980s or general reform in the 1980s and 90s, which was really accepted broadly by the community. But is reform feasible in today's very toxic and hyper-partisan climate? Don't you need more of the sort of political climate we had in those times, which was facilitated by the accord with the trade union movement and by at least some bipartisanship, not entire bipartisanship, of course, but some for changes. But today it just seems that the level of public distrust and the level of hyper-partisanship makes it nearly impossible to get anything much done.
Well, it may be a bit worse now. I think we can easily exaggerate just how good the 1980s, I mean, I think the results achieved were very good. But I think the important points to it, in looking back on the 1880s and 90s, and I was pretty involved in all that personally, was that those reforms were preceded by quite a long period of public debate and research. I mean, Max Corden worked out the, if you like, the economic costs of the tariff.
This was a prominent economist.
Yeah, prominent economist. Worked out how we could assess the economic costs of tariff protection in the late 1950s. And we didn't actually make the big changes until the 1980s. So there was a long period. And you can say the same thing with financial deregulation, that financial deregulation was vigorously opposed by the Treasury even in the 1980s, or sorry, 1970s, but into the 1980s. But a lot of research was done, and frankly, in the end, a lot of the changes were because the regulations weren't working. They were just breaking down. I mean, you can think of that with the financial regulations.
And this was obviously also international pressure to open the economy.
Yeah, there was. But, yeah, they, it wasn't working. I mean, you know, we could see we were going backwards in terms of competitiveness under the tariff. You could see that people could go and get a loan. They couldn't get a bank loan because of the interest rate controls. The banks wouldn't, they'd only lend to the rich. So a poor person went somewhere else and paid a higher interest rate. They just weren't working as they were intended to work. So I think there was an OECD publication, or quite a long time ago, which went through where countries have changed course. And it came to the conclusion countries only ever changed course in a crisis. And I think we had a sense of crisis by the 1980s. You remember the Banana Republic speech, you know, that we were, Keating, where he said we look, risk being a banana republic unless we reform. And I think the Australian public was conscious we were slipping down the league leadership. But, you know, where are we today? We're not slipping down. We're doing extraordinarily well. We're the only country that hasn't had a recession in the last quarter of a century.
So does this breed a dangerous complacency, or does it really mean that we don't need so much reform so we can, to some extent, sit back?
Well, my argument would be we do need to make reforms. We haven't got agreement on what ones yet. I would focus...
Without the crisis?
Yeah, without the crisis.
It's not clear, is it? It's
very hard. And yeah, but you know, ideally, you shorten the time delays... But and you avoid the crisis. How do you shorten the time delays? I think, frankly, we need to provide a lot more information and encourage a lot more debate. And my sense is that governments are unwilling to provide the amount of information that they used to provide. I mean, if I look at the information in the budgets, I can remember there was an international review of comparing different countries' budget information. And Australia topped it in the 1980s. We were the best. I don't think we'd be anywhere near the best today. I don't think we provide as much as we provided then. One of the good things about the Accord was that a huge amount of information was put on the public record, and that helped change the nature of the debate. You know, things like, you know, the Economic Planning Advisory Council, which had business and the ACTU and so on. We had a continuing debate about good policy and, you know, what the nature of the problems were, which was evidence-based. Now, I don't think we're getting that at the moment.
So what's changed? Is it that governments want more control and therefore they want to restrict the information? Or is it because our politics is more adversarial and at that period it was more consensus-based?
I don't know the answer, Michelle. You might have a better answer than me. But I do think governments need to be, if they want to govern, as distinct from telling people what they want to hear and being, really pulled this way and that by public opinion, not very well informed public opinion and politics, then they need to be prepared to take some risks in terms of putting public information out. But, you know, the sort of secrecy stuff that's going on at the moment, information, I must say, as a former head of the public service, a former head of PM&C, I would have thought we could make available. You look at an FOI, it's blacked out all the time. And, you know, I don't think that's in the government's interests in the end.
And there's been a big change too in the lack of access that journalists have to the senior public servants these days.
Is there? I don't know. But it doesn't, let me put it this way, it doesn't surprise me, because I just don't think they're as willing to, you know, to take some risks which would enable them to actually govern better.
It would be nice to see some change. Michael Keating, thank you very much for talking with us today, and all the best with your book. It's a great piece of work. That's all from today's Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.